the default position for a fulfilled and thriving life. It's what God intended. And only under special circumstances, obviously there are circumstances, the church has for its whole tradition exalted people who have chosen to live single lives, the Holy that extols himself, right? Like, hey, live a single life. But it's only in extraordinary situations where God has called you to it. In general, we don't do that. The fact that that sounds so strange and sexist just shows how far we have fallen, I would argue. And frankly, the truth is right in front of our face. We just don't want to admit that every problem in society can be traced at some level to the breakdown of the family, and that this is Satan's plan for getting people to hell, and that this involves, I mean, think about the guy who was trying to break into our house, right? Here's a guy who's essentially running around like a zombie, drugged out of his mind, following his fleshly appetites to their end. What? Like, he's literally acting like an animal in heat. He's not acting like a human. That's what sin does. That's what sexual immorality does. So how does Satan accomplish that? How does he get us to the point where we've got, 250-pound muscular men running around, we've got women selling themselves on OnlyFans, we've got 13-year-olds cutting off their breasts? What is going on? Well, here's what Satan does. He does what he always does. He lies. Satan's a liar, right? He lies about who you are, what you need to do to achieve happiness. And he does it in the most audacious way possible. And actually, the lie really hasn't changed that much from the beginning, right? He claimed we would be like gods, and it made us less like God. Another way to say that is that he offered us freedom, and in doing so, enslaved us. I think freedom today is the main selling point that Satan offers. That he uses lies about liberty. And in the West especially, this is a rather ingenious way to do it, isn't it? Sell your insidious agenda as liberty, as freedom from tyranny and oppression. I mean, who doesn't want freedom from tyranny and oppression? We're Americans, darn it. We want freedom from tyranny and oppression. That's our whole basis for existence. We throw off people who are oppressing us. No kings, no masters for us, right? It's liberty or death. We are a revolutionary people. Because we know there are oppressive systems, right, that we want to be free from. Fascism, communism, racism-inspired oppression, slavery, Jim Crow laws, sexist laws that deny women certain rights. I mean, these are all bad things. There's no question about it. And to desire to be free from those things is a natural and good thing. Because remember, God made us free. That was what it means to be in the image of God, partially, is that we have freedom. But Satan uses that natural desire to be free, and also the natural desire to be free from injustice, and he deceptively twists it into a sinful, prideful desire to be our own gods and masters. He confuses that issue for us, the issue of liberty, to lead us astray. And how is he going to do that? Well, I think he's got a several-step process. And there's others, but for Americans, I'm going to stick with these ones. Okay? Historically, in the last 500 years, I think this is what happened. Obscure the way we think about human identity. So confuse us about our place in the world. Confuse us about what it means to be human. And in doing so, confuse us about the way we understand freedom and liberty. Redefine it. And then he'll be able to paint legitimate authorities and proper restraints in our lives as evil enslavers rather than the freedom-giving entities that they are. And it'll actually confuse us about the real oppressors and actual freedom. And it will become such a mess that none of us will be able to think straight. So that at the end of all these machinations, he'll have young girls cutting off their breasts, taking away their ability to have children, taking away even their sexual pleasure, becoming lifetime slaves to a medical industrial complex that's making billions off them, so that they can what? Be free to be me. Or middle-aged, sexually deviant men who are addicted to porn and their fetishes who want to enter girls' locker rooms at the health club, because to deny them that is to deny them the freedom to be their true selves. Right? You're constricting my liberty by not letting me do that. Well, this is exactly the opposite of what's actually happening. So what we're going to do is cover some of the history of this. Where did this freedom talk start? And frankly, although you might think it started in the 60s, you think of, and it was big, we're going to get to the 60s. Think of the terms we 60s. Well, I was born in 70, so not me. I'm old, but not quite that old. But some of us remember the 60s. Women's liberation, gay liberation, free love. These are liberating terms, right? And actually, though, we can go back much farther. For our purposes, I'm going to go back to the beginning of the Modern Project, the very foundation of liberalism, which, by the way, should be distinguished from liberals today. I don't think there's much happening in America that is not built on classical liberalism. But we do have liberals today that are far from anything. They followed it, but I'm talking about classical liberalism of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment changed the way we think about ourselves and the world around us in very, very significant ways. So we're going to talk about first the tenets of Enlightenment liberalism, especially as it is distinguished from classical medieval Christian thought. And I don't hope this doesn't get too esoteric, but this, if you can get this, honestly, everything else in the world makes sense. Here's what happened at the beginning of the Enlightenment. We got a new understanding of the nature of our relationships with each other. Okay? So in the past, at least in Christian Europe, in Christendom, in Western Christianity, how did we understand each other? Well, it was a relationship to each other, our family, right? Our dependence on each other. So we would grow up in a family, which is part of a clan, which then would be part of a village or a society, and maybe even a nation. But they didn't really even have nations pre-Enlightenment. You had cultural groups. But the nation state is sort of an Enlightenment thing, isn't it? Well, it makes sense because we changed the way we thought about our understanding. And guys like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, very influential people in the history of America, by the way, came up with something called social contract theory. And rather than the hierarchical social structures that we used to live in, they posited that, in fact, that was not our natural state, right? So for Christianity, our natural state is to live in family. We were created to live with each other. We just talked about that all talk about. They said, no, our original state is one of complete individualism, that man's natural condition is to be like little atoms, completely separate from every other little atom in the universe. And that as individuals, we're essentially in competition with every other individual. However, because a state of war is not a way to continue on, right? That we sometimes enter into contracts with each other so that we don't all die. But these contracts are voluntary and should only be entered into to the point where I'm still happy with it. So I want that piece of ground, you want that piece of ground. Rather than kill each other over it, why don't you take half and you grow grain, I'll take half and I'll run some cattle, you can sell me some beef in the fall, I'll sell you some grain for your cattle, and we'll enter into a contract and we'll have a community. Oh, fair enough, right? Now, that social contract theory was the basis of everything that happened, frankly, post-Reformation. We're talking about 1500 and on, really. There was some stuff that happened in the Middle Ages that we don't necessarily get to, but this was a stark difference, right? The way we think about each other. It changed the way we think about governments, for example. So when in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, he says there comes a time when we get to overthrow our governments because governments derive their right from the consent of the governed. Well, what does that mean? The consent of the governed means that I entered into a contract with you. I let you have that power. But as soon as I don't want that or you're being too authoritarian or too controlling, I now have the right to end that contract. And that's what we did to King George, right? Like, and so we kind of get that. Like, yeah, okay, a revolution when we don't like it. But understand that, you know, that's all well and good if you're writing the Declaration of Independence to a point. But it didn't stop at overthrowing political regimes that we didn't like. It also applied then to things like family and religion and other institutions that we didn't get to choose. I grew up in a church, or I grew up in this tradition. If, you know, you're living in 16th century Europe, well, I didn't get to choose it, you see. And if I don't get to choose it, then it's not a voluntary contract. And so I'm going to rebel against that. choose. Okay? So, for example, the French Revolution took this quite literally, and Enlightenment philosopher Denis Diderot famously said, man will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. Why kings and priests? Because kings, I didn't get to choose. It's a monarchy. It's a traditional institution. It's not entered into voluntarily, so it's got to go. Religion, I didn't get to choose. It's not a voluntary institution. They claim to have a divine right, same as the divine right of kings. It's not voluntary, so it doesn't fit into my social contract theory, so we will revolt. And so the French Revolution literally revolted. But it wasn't actually that much different in philosophy to the American Revolution. I understand there's a difference. I get it. Don't get me wrong. But philosophically, the main difference was that France had the institutions to revolt against, and America didn't. So in America, that revolution, after we had thrown off King George, looked a little bit different, right? It did look a little bit more about revolting against things like traditional religion and, ultimately, family. And these things take hundreds of years to really see how they flow out, but at the Enlightenment, they were already there, okay? Freedom, also, is changed in this. Notice, freedom in a social contract theory is the ability to do whatever I want. So anybody that tells me anything, I automatically say, I don't want that, right? Any sort of, like, telling me outside of my free will, my choice, it is automatically suspect, and I'm going to throw it off. So freedom and liberty becomes more what we would call libertarian or even anarchist, right? And this is different, right? This is different than the classical understanding of freedom. For a medieval man, freedom was the ability to do good by controlling the animalistic desires of living according to our nature. For modern man, freedom is the ability to act out every animalistic desire I might have. And if I don't get to act it out, I am not free. And that's a big difference, right? There's a difference between freedom to do right or to do good or to do anything. Like, I don't have the ability to play in the NBA or the NHL or any sports or my local beer league, frankly. I don't have the ability to do that. I don't have the freedom. I don't have the physical ability, the intellectual ability. I don't know the game well enough. To have the freedom to do that, I would really have to discipline myself. I probably would have had to discipline myself from a young age. Plus, I would have had the genetic gifts to do it. So I just don't have the freedom, right? Today, to not have the freedom to do it, well, how dare you tell me what I can't do? You get all sorts of nonsense, right? You're telling kids, oh, be whatever you want to be. I don't want to be a classical pianist. Oh, are you going to practice at this point? Yourself? No, I just want to be a classical pianist. No, that's not like what we're telling kids based on this libertarian idea, right? Charles Fournier, another, the French give us a lot of bad philosophy, unfortunately. The greatest freedom and greatest unity among men will come from giving full rein to the passions, especially passionate attraction. So this is a new understanding of freedom. Okay? And then this results in, essentially, a new understanding of ourselves, or at least it did. We have Descartes offering us, and among many, we're not going to get into all the philosophers here, but Cartesian dualism is kind of a famous one, right? Splits the mind and body and grants priority to the mind. So formally, the human beings were understood as hylomorphic beings. We're a unity of body, soul, spirit. That's inseparable. You can't separate our body from ourselves. To do so results in death. Right? I mean, to separate your body from your soul and spirit, we have a name for that. It's called death. Well, that understanding, Descartes and following, I mean, he didn't, a lot of these guys didn't see logically where this was going to go, but they laid the foundation for it, right? He splits the mind and the body as two separate entities and makes the mind or the spirit or the will superior, okay? So then on top of that, and this is where we have to go back and then look at nominalism and things like this, which we won't spend a lot of time on, but the philosophical basis of the Enlightenment is a rejection of essentialism and teleology, which is to say that things have a nature, an inherent meaning that just is. So the inherent meaning, you know, classically, of an acorn is to grow into an oak. That's what it does. That's what it is. The inherent meaning of humans, I argued in Talk 1, was to love each other and to love God. Modernism, the Enlightenment, threw all that out the window, and more of these various revolutionary movements have much more in common than we might admit. So, for example, some people try to separate, like, the early women's rights movement from later ones, you know, first wave, second wave, third wave feminism. We're going to see that they're all the same, really. The gay rights movement. The gay rights are now trying to separate themselves from the trans movement. And you can be sure that neither the women's movement nor the gay movement wants the transhumanism movement that's on its way. They're all those groups are trying to disavow the growing pedophile rights movement. But actually, they're all the same. They're all the same at their base. They're a satanic revolt against God's plan for the family, and they succumb to the devil's basic, the same basic strategy. And the main problem of each of those things that I just listed is that they don't see that the natural default situation of biological men and women is marrying, raising children, and that you don't have sex before you're in that situation, because it's bad for everybody involved. This is what I try to tell my high schoolers constantly, okay? You can come, I had a kid come say, she's like a 20-something, she said, you know, I really want to try to get close to Jesus, but the fact is found out I'm living with my boyfriend and I don't want to stop, but, you know, what should I do? I said, well, if you really want to get close to Jesus, you got to move out. Okay, I'm sorry. She didn't like that. Never saw her again. And you might say, well, that's mean. You know, shouldn't you be more welcoming? No, because living with her boyfriend is bad for her. Okay? If she continued on that path, her life is worse off than it would have been if she had moved out right then. I gave her the right advice. This is bad for people. It's not loving to let people continue in destructive lifestyles. Okay? This is what we're going to see. So let's start. We're going to focus on women in this talk. We're going to do it very quickly because they always play a major role in the story. They're the ones who can carry your life, like I talked about. Today, you might think it would be the best time in history for women, right? I mean, female empowerment, feminist thought has become the dogma of modern Western civilization. We've got female superheroes, single mothers are saints, right? Even better, women with no babies at all. I mean, that's really where you want. The famous picture from a few years ago of all the G8 leaders. Have you seen that one? Maybe it was even bigger than G8, but all of the Western leaders, and not a single one of those leaders had a kid. Like, they were all single. It's something to think about. We were being ruled by the childless class. And we think that that's a good thing. I assure you, it is not. The fact is, women are far more depressed than they ever have been. And this applies not just to teenagers. I mean, I talk about teens. Middle-aged women are absolutely depressed. They're depressed because they're now too old to have kids and they wish they had them before. They wasted all their time on their career or whatever it was. They've gone through all these failed relationships because that was supposed to fulfill them. And now they find themselves, you know, 49, childless, no family, alone and depressed. And they've done everything the culture told them to do. Are they happy? No, they're absolutely miserable. I assure you they're miserable. Good quote from Rachel Wilson has a good book on this. She says, in 1890, the average age of women got married was 22. Now the average 22-year-old woman is graduating college with an OnlyFans business in hopes of paying down her massive student debt. Meanwhile, the top 20 careers most commonly held by women, according to the U.S. Department of Labor, are much the same type of work they would have traditionally done at home for their family, such as secretary, assistant, nurse, teacher, waitress, childcare provider. Only now they get to pay taxes and send their own kids to daycare for the privilege. And that really kind of sums up a lot of the situation. So we're going to start with some feminist pioneers. Understand what the early feminists. Listen, they're not. Again, we tend to think, if we haven't studied it too much, that the early feminists were the good ones. You know, the later ones were not so great. We all want the votes. It wasn't that great. Abolition, all that. In actuality, no, they weren't primarily after the vote. They weren't about having equal rights to law school, as good as that is. I mean, and again, throughout this talk, don't get me wrong, women have been oppressed. The reason there's women's rights movements is that they have been oppressed. Like, you know, women should be able to get a credit card in their own name, right? This is not something, but that was mid to late 20th century before that stuff happened, right? I get it. But let's understand that the women's rights movement has not been this righteous thing for justice. We'll start in Britain, then we'll get to the U.S. again. We're going to do this in super speed. Mary Wollstonecraft wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Women way back in 1792. Again, this is the time of the revolution. She wrote it during the French Revolution. In response, by the way, to Edmund Burke's politically conservative close friends, actually, with Thomas Paine. If you know your U.S. history, Thomas Paine had a major role in the Revolutionary War. He's the one who wrote Common Sense that really pushed us into the war. And then when George Washington and the crew were on the other side of the Delaware and things were looking bad, it was Thomas Paine who wrote The American Crisis and inspired us to get across. Well, Thomas Paine, you know, has his issues, too. He was very much in this crowd with Mary Wollstonecraft and her anarchist future husband, although just for a little while because he was a bad dude too, William Godwin. But let me talk real quick before that. Vindication of the Rights of Women basically just rails against the monarchy, a standing military, rails against the church. All of these things are incompatible with freedom. She also, though, applies this to the relationship between men and women. She says that women are expected to be mindless drones with no freedom, and that they shouldn't chase after love or respect for a man. That we are our own people. They should be seen first and foremost as citizens rather than women. And so she already, back in the late 1700s, is driving the understanding of women away from motherhood and biological realities to a more political understanding, a more Renaissance, or sorry, Enlightenment understanding. The guy she eventually married was William Godwin. He believed marriage was a bad thing because it possessed the women. It was selfish. But here was his reason. It unnaturally enslaved. You notice the slavery words are always coming up here, right? Freedom and slavery. It unnaturally enslaved male sexuality. This was the beginning of the free love movement. Godwin, in his appeal to liberty, wanted to be able to just have sex with whoever he wants. And he did. Okay, this is a bad dude. And again, this is going to be a recurring theme, how much of feminism is directly influenced by bad men who are not fulfilling their God-given role as good fathers, and that they call that freedom. So Godwin, he was an atheist. He actually wouldn't attend Wollstonecraft's funeral because he believed there's no life after death. He had a bunch of illegitimate children, but he was quite a celebrity. In fact, after Eric Burr killed Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel, Godwin invited him over, had him over to his place to his house for lunch. Friends with the Marquis de Sade, sadism, sexual violence. These guys are working at the same time, okay? There's a lot going on in the 1700s that is a direct corollary to what we're seeing today, that we need to be basically pornographic and sexually immoral in the name of freedom and liberty, okay? Another famous person a little bit later on, but now we'll move to England, was Percy Shelley. Now, Wollstonecraft, let me tell you this story, and Godwin had a daughter, Mary Shelley. Mary Godwin, so you may not know her. You probably know the term Mary Shelley. That's the author of Frankenstein. Well, Mary Shelley married Percy Shelley. Well, eventually. Married in these days was a bit of an indie term. Percy Shelley is an avowed atheist and free love advocate who believed that chastity outside of marriage was, quote, a monkish and evangelical superstition, and he apparently encouraged his wife to have sex with other men because this was more proper to the state of nature. Okay? Now, Shelley's indicative of the Romantics, which was a reaction to the rationalism of people like Kant, who were like religion within the limits of reason alone. Okay? And again, to back up, I would argue that the Reformation and the Enlightenment basically threw the world into epistemic crisis. Okay, and we can talk about, obviously, the very values. We're not going to talk about all the differences here, but I don't think historically there's any doubt that epistemically, like how do we know what we know, was an absolute free-for-all in Europe and the West after 1500. Because how do I know? Is it the Bible? Is it my mind? Is it my heart? This is what the Romantics said. Is it my heart? Eventually we're going to go to Spiritism, but they're grasping. And so Shelley rejects the rationalism that said, I'm not going to listen to the church or the Bible, but I'll listen to my head. And he says, no, I'm not going to listen to my head either. I'm going to listen to my heart. Okay? And this was the Romantic movement. So he believed that poetry was the key to knowledge of truth, combined with a few drugs and alcohol. Well, Percy Shelley got together with Mary after he saw a chance to get some of her wealth. And he abandoned his pregnant wife and ran off with her 16-year-old Mary Shelley and her stepsister Claire, who he also seduced, by the way. Percy's first love suicide after he ran off. Well, Claire, who was Mary Shelley's sister, I know this is like a soap opera, but this is just history, right? Claire eventually ran off and later became the lover of an even more famous poet, Lord Byron, and had a daughter with him. But here's how she sums up her relationships with both Percy Shelley and Lord Byron. Under the influence of the doctrine of free love, I saw the first two poets of England become monsters of meanness, cruelty, treachery. Under the influence of free love, Lord Byron became a human tiger, slaking his thirst for inflicting pain upon defenseless women who, under the influence of free love, loved him. Well, Shelley and his wife Mary wove the thought of Wollstonecraft and Darwin together in a very influential way. Percy was more prone to combine science and spiritualism, which we'll see. Mary was a little bit suspect of it. She wrote Frankenstein, which was what? An appeal to conquer nature and make it do what we want, right? That's what Frankenstein's about. She was a little more wary as the woman, okay? But that's the background of that. Percy Shelley had a horrible effect, and today he's celebrated as the great English poet, like every literature class in the country is going to be celebrating these guys. Then, now, again, I talked about just reading Paradise Lost to my high schoolers, and Milton was writing, of course, you're familiar with Paradise Lost. It was the great Protestant epic to match all the classic epics. Free verse, it's about the fall of man. But what was interesting about Paradise Lost, or whether Milton, I don't think he necessarily intended this, but Milton paints Satan in Paradise Lost. It's about Satan revolting and tempting. Satan comes off pretty darn well in Paradise Lost. Like, he's pretty heroic. The poem opens up, the angels are all defeated, they're lying, and Satan courageously, he's like Mel Gibson in Braveheart, or Aragorn in Lord of the Rings, courageously stands up as the reigning and says, we will not, you know, be defeated. Let's rise up and fight against the oppressive government, the oppressive ruler that is inflicting his will on us, God. Well, in a time of revolutions, how are people going to interpret that? As if Satan is the hero. And indeed, Percy Shelley wrote a poem, Revolt of Islam, where he explicitly makes Satan the liberator of women, the hero of that poem is Sintha, the earthly messenger of Satan, who defies gender roles and overthrows the male hierarchy. He says he wrote the poem in the view of kindling in my readers a virtuous enthusiasm for the doctrines of liberty and justice and create a counter-myth to the hegemonic story of Christianity. Okay, these are anti-Christian, satanic ideas that are being published, and they're absolutely the archetype for everything that's going to come. So for him, the new archetype woman has no connection to children, no connection to family, no connection to motherhood. In fact, he already saw that in the future, sex distinctions, which he saw as detestable, would surely be abolished in a future state of being. Percy Shelley was also a fan of the Marquis de Sade. Both he and Mary were connected to his work. Eventually, Shelley was exiled from Britain because of sexual scandal, but that wore off after his death, and now he's considered a heroic poet. So let's move to America then, and religious life in the early 19th century. I mean, let's not pretend that there was no problems in the 19th century in America, right? Society was rapidly changing. The spirit of revolution and utopianism was in the air. And again, like sometimes we make a distinction, and there is definitely a distinction between the French and American revolutions. But the spirit of rejecting authority continued. But in America, there was no establishment to revolt against. You had the disestablishment clause. You also had Protestantism in general left America as a somewhat of a free-for-all spiritually. Okay? And it was a perfect breeding ground then for revolutionary excess and the same anti-mother, anti-family attitude. As the Tocqueville famously wrote, there's plenty of spirituality in America, but it was pretty shallow. Okay? Faith was characterized by itinerant preachers, emotional excess, a lack of institutional control. The elites went for rationalistic Christian heresies, Unitarianism, deism. The low spiritual experiential second great awakening takes place. And again, I mean no disrespect, I grew up in absolutely the revivalist tradition. I love it with all my heart in many respects, but let's not pretend that there wasn't some serious errors, such as the one I'm going to tell you here in a minute. Also, and let me throw one more thing out there. There was quite a need for reform in the culture. So by the mid-19th century, I mean, America was far less Christian than the Puritans would have hoped when they landed on our shores. Consumerism, the Tocqueville really makes a clear picture of what consumerism looked like. Greed and avarice, any preaching against that had fallen by the wayside. A lot of alcoholism, a lot of sexual debauchery, 20,000 prostitutes in New York City alone, brothels everywhere. Of course, the slavery issue is still a big one. So there's a sense of injustice, but does it need to be reformed? Or do we need to revolt against it, right? Well, in an Enlightenment revolt attitude, we revolt. Because we don't reform, what does that mean? That would assume there's some sort of good to control against, right? We revolt. And so they did. And one of the more interesting areas of utopianism and revolt was the Burnover District of upstate New York. So this was after the Erie Canal got built and economic access is coming to the upper area of Buffalo, Erie, that whole area, right? Well, it was also a time for big ideas. So Charles Grandison Finney was the most famous preacher in America at the time. He's the one who sort of made evangelicalism into a model. I mean, I grew up studying him. Like, how do we hold a crusade to get people to walk us on us, trail, all that stuff, right? Well, he was pretty heretical in many ways. He was probably the best of all the rest that we're going to talk about. But there was a lot of spiritualism happening here. And a lot, by the way, of new religions, new faiths, that had a sexual element to them. That somehow the traditional understanding of marriage and family had gone by the wayside. So we'll talk about the Fox sisters, who were spiritualists and medium. But we'll also talk about the United Community here quickly. Think about Mormonism. I won't spend much time on Mormonism, but what was the thing with Mormonism? Polygamy. All right? The United Community, which we'll talk about that. Now, a lot of this, as we'll notice, had to do with, we no longer need to, you know, one man, one woman live together forever.
No.
We don't need to do that. We can have a lot more promiscuous sex than we thought before. So let's talk about the Oneida community. If you maybe have something of Oneida silverware, this is where it came from. Perfectionist commune that made famous the term. As a fact, they were very good with their money, but they were also very good at producing what was basically a sex cult. Okay, the idea that he came up with, and here we're talking about John Humphrey Noyce, was what he called complex marriage, whereas any consenting member of the community could have sex with any other consenting member of the community. that's what he came up with. He believed that Jesus had returned in 70 AD, and that man was now living in a new age, and perfection was possible, and he declared himself actually free from sin in 1834, and this new utopia could be, because there will be no marriage in heaven, he said, we could have that on earth, we'll have complex marriage, and that it was selfish and sinful to possess another in a mutually exclusive relationship. And feminists actually look back on the United community as a good thing because women were considered equal to men. Traditional motherhood was rejected completely. Children were actually raised by the commune. They would, as soon as the child was weaned, they would pull the child away and raise it in a different part, like the school part of the community. They practiced formal contraception. They actually practiced a form of eugenics where they chose the breeders to, like, they didn't let everybody have kids. Because you know what? Sex raises kids. Well, we can't have that, right? And this is a constant thing we're going to see too, right? So they had to have not only contraception, but a eugenics window where they only let certain people produce the right kids. So if you were a breeder, you got to have kids, but if you were not, you had to practice contraception. They were persecuted, and they fled when he got called up on statutory rape charges. Surprise, surprise, when you produce a sex cult, kids are going to be sexually objectified, and women are going to be abused, and of course, that's what happened in the United community. Some of them actually ran, I taught my kids in Orange County, some of them actually ran to Orange County, and they were the first, they were the ones that produced Orange County. homosexual relationship. You have to stop it from producing children. You have to make it even more of an object than it already is, and in the process, a lot of pain and suffering. All right, let's move on to the transcendentalists. This is Ralph Waldo Emerson and Dana Hoffman, people like that. They reject orthodoxy and tradition of any kind. The self was free of any external restraint or law. No traditions should be trusted or followed. This was the start of the New Age movement in the U.S. Again, these are famous. You're going to read all of these guys in literature class. You don't always get the sort of sordid history. Ralph Waldo Emerson, for example, essayist, lecturer, philosopher, gave one of the most famous speeches in American history in 1837 called The American Scholar, which basically called for unfettered liberty from any previous tradition. It was called the American Intellectual Declaration of Independence. Now let me just read a little bit from it. In self-trust, all the virtues are comprehended. Free should the scholar be, free and brave, free even to the definition of freedom. Without any hindrances, not the rise out of its own constitution. He's saying, we should be able to be free enough that I get to define what freedom is. Like, I should have absolutely no intellectual restraints on whatever I say or do or believe. That's where we had gone. Could he see where that was going? Probably not. Again, they were so full of the Christian tradition that the morals took a while. But he was saying explicitly, this is what we're supposed to be. Later on, he wrote an essay called Self-Reliance. He says, whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather immortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must explore if it be goodness. Nothing at last is sacred but the integrity of your own mind. You see what he's saying there? I get to define what goodness is. Nothing is sacred but my own ideas. He again, later on, he responds, well, somebody might say, well, what if your ideas are from the devil? And he says, well, they do not seem to be such. But if I am the devil's child, I will have them from the devil. No law can be sacred to me but that of my nature. Good and bad are but names very readily transferable to this or that. The only right is what is after my constitution. The only wrong is what is against it. So you can see the radical relativism, the radical individualism, the chaos that this is going to result in. Did they see it at the time? Probably not, but this is 1837 still. Okay. We'll click on to some more transcendentalists. Margaret Fuller, her book Women in the 19th Century is credited with sparkling the suffrage movement. She was one of the first to argue that gender categories could be abolished, but that was because she was basically a New Age mystic who believed in Eastern oneness. We're all part of the one. There is no gender anyway. It's all illusion, right? But she inspired people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, who we all know are quite famous in the women's movement. More utopian experiments followed. We had a rising confidence that mankind was perfectible. Brook Farm, where men and women, we had men washing dishes at Brook Farm, women were out in the fields, and they thought, you know, and again, nothing wrong with that. I wash the dishes every single day in our house. That's just a fact. I don't consider it non-masculine. It's just something people do, right? But they were trying to usurp traditional men, female and male roles. And this was quite, a lot of the transcendentalists actually went to Brook Farm. New Harmony, Indiana is another famous utopian experiment. Robert Owen was a median who contacted Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Notice the writings of Marx and Engels are also coming during this time, right? And we'll talk about that tomorrow. They're inspired by places like Brook Farm and some of the ideas that are coming out of America. The Fox Sisters, another burned over district classic, three sisters from upstate New York, who one day heard rapping, like rapping on the table, and claimed that it was a spirit talking to them, and then they claimed basically that the spirit told them that there was a dead body, that somebody had been murdered in the house, and then somebody found some bones, and so they were terrified, and they became superstars, and traveled all over America and Europe, doing seances and mediums for people and getting money. They confessed at one time that it was all a scam, that they were pulling the levers themselves, and then they recanted. I guess the money was too much. But the Fox Sisters are extolled in feminist circles because women were having a voice now. That women were making money and speaking on tours and were the ones on the stage, and this was a good thing, right? Even if they were con artists and Charlottesville. Elizabeth Gay Stand is one of our premier converts in Charlottesville. She's the force behind the Seneca Falls Convention, the author of its Declaration of Sentiments, which, by the way, if you read Declaration of Sentiments, it's basically it's word for word cut and paste from the Declaration of Independence. She just throws in, instead of wanting to attack the King of England and impeach him, she puts men in that category. Our husbands, our fathers, our brothers, our husbands, they need to be overthrown. They need to be revolted against. She was a spiritualist. She used a spirit table. In fact, she wrote her declaration on it. And the spirit table is what the Fox sisters used at Seoul to practice their seances. Okay. Later, she wrote the Women's Bible with some friends, which was explicit in its reversal of the Genesis story that we read in talk number one, where Satan is explicitly the hero of the story, freeing women from the oppressive, evil patriarch that is God the Father. This became a very famous book, sold a ton still to this day. I mean, you can find women's Bibles in the bookstore, but hopefully this one doesn't show up in the Christian bookstore. She was inspired by Theosophy. This was a major, major player in the women's movement throughout its history. It combined spiritualism, occultism, various traditions from around the world, started by an expressly Satanist woman from Russia named Petrovna Blavatsky. She published a journal called Lucifer. She blamed the Bible for patriarchy. It's extremely, extremely anti-Christian. As they do, she advocated for the legalization of prostitution, eugenics, sterilization, socialism, and a secular state in the name of freedom and liberty for women. So you see the theme here, where we're going. Victoria Woodhull has one of the better stories. She was actually known as Mrs. Staten, spiritualist, free love advocate, famous as the first woman to run for president. So her dad was a con artist. Her and Tenny, her sister, would travel around with their dad with a snake oil salesman. They'd go to fairs and sell, if you know the snake oil story, it's just basically vegetable oil or tar or whatever it is. You just sell it as a cure-all. They went and did that, and also it seems they did some mediums and seances, readings on the side, maybe sold their bodies a little bit, practiced a little prostitution as well. Not a very good upbringing, shall we say. But they happened to run into one Cornelius Vanderbilt one day. And Vanderbilt, who was one of the richest men in the world at the time, had them do a reading for him. And they told him what stocks that he should buy and dump the next day, right before the big fall in 1920. And it worked. No, sorry, not the 18s. This was still back in the 1860s. It worked. Okay? It paid off. And he was so fascinated by this that not only did he start a sexual relationship with Tennessee Clapton, but he kept the Fox sisters close to him by starting, and this is what you'll read in the textbooks, the first woman to have a Wall Street brokerage firm was Victoria and her sister, Tennessee, with Vanderbilt's money, because they were the ones giving him stock tips based on their mediums and seances. Now, the reality of the story is that they were prostitutes with a ring of prostitutes who were also sleeping with a bunch of well-connected men, and they knew the insider information because the prostitutes would get the insider information, and they sold it to Vanderbilt. That's what we think happened. But they became extremely famous and powerful, started Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, which was the first women on the newspaper, and the first two print Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. Do you see a theme where the feminism and the communism is all coming together, and it's all very anti-woman, anti-family? She was, that's what I'm trying to say. We'll end here with a couple of more. Tilda Jocelyn Gaze helped write the Women's Bible, then wrote her own Women, Church, and State in 1893, devoted theosophist, occultist, advocated for the cultural acceptance of witches. That was her main claim to fame. Now, here's something else about Matilda. She was friends with Maud and Frank Baum, who you might know as the authors of a very famous tale called The Wizard of Oz. Now, The Wizard of Oz has become a legend, but what you may not think about these days is the way that it treats witches. Yes, there's an evil witch, but there's also a good witch. And the idea that there of social injustice and the patriarchy, and it was just misunderstood, is the idea that they were pushing and that took form in the culture, so that now witches are almost uniformly a good thing in our culture. Okay? And we can go through more contemporary times, I mean, 20th century witchcraft, the 60s and 70s, if you read accounts of Greenwich Village or San Francisco at the time, it is highly, highly occultic, with a lot of sex fetishes and demonism and just nasty, nasty stuff. Right, that is a little bit combined with that. But the spirituality and the acceptance of witchcraft, I mean, today, from Samantha the Teenage Witch to Wicked, I mean, every witch, every Disney movie you can notice, is now taking what used to be the classic story of the Winter Witches, like classic stories in the old fairy tales. What are witches known for? Hating children, eating children, killing children. They're childless women. That's what a witch is. An anti-mother. Okay, that's how we define witches. They're anti-motherhood. Now that is celebrated. That is the thing to be, is to be anti-mother. Yeah, there's been TikToks in the last week that go viral about some 29, don't watch these, but I saw a 29-year-old the other day on a Saturday. She went through her Saturday as a childless 29-year-old, and she got widely mocked, but she also got several million views saying, hey, go girl, good job. And it was just, we look at you like, you're living a completely meaningless, selfish life, and you know you're depressed, and you quit her on TikTok. But you think about what we've done to all those witch stories. Now we rewrite the witch stories, like Wicked, for example. Isn't it not a rewriting of all the witch as heroes? Okay? All of the, Maleficent, I don't think, is a witch, but all, as a father of kids, I know that all the Disney movies have taken the evil queens and rewrote them now as heroes. They're just misunderstood. It's probably the patriarchy. Even, like, very bad women, like the one who skinned the Dalmatians. What am I thinking of? Cruella de Vil, the latest. If you watch the latest live-action Cruella de Vil movie, she is a misunderstood, damaged by her father woman who just needs to be heroicized, right? That's where we are. We have taken the feminist movement. In fact, I'll quote Rachel Wilson here again. The spirit of feminism is one of rebellion against authority, rejection of societal expectation, and inversion of Christianity. That's why we often, though not always, find overlap between witchcraft practice and expressly satanic beliefs. But whether an atheist, technocrat, or a pagan goddess worshiper, all those roads lead to the same conclusion regarding feminist ideology, that the family, marriage, and ultimately motherhood must be destroyed in order for women to be truly liberated. This false satanic freedom that only enslaves